welcome to Everything Co-op, bringing you information on how cooperatives can help improve your quality of life. This show is being sponsored by the National Co-op Bank, NCB. The NCB is dedicated to strengthening communities nationwide for the delivery of banking and financial services for the nation's cooperatives, their members, and other socially responsible organizations. For more information on the power of community ownership, visit ncb.coop. That's ncb.coop. Now stay tuned for your host, Vernon Oakes.
Good morning, everybody. This is Vernon Oakes. Welcome to Everything Co-op. This morning, we have the pleasure of talking to folks from the Northeast, the Cooperative Fund of the Northeast. Good morning, Micah.
Good morning, Vernon. Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Thank you for being on. And Carolyn, good morning.
Good morning. Great to be here.
And Jonah, good morning, sir.
Good morning. Good morning, Joe. But I appreciate you still.
Okay. Well, I got Miha right. Okay, so what is the Cooperative Fund of the Northeast? Who would like to tell us what it is?
Yes, yeah, so I can do that. So Cooperative Fund of the Northeast, our story started in 1975. Communities across the Northeast were starting and expanding community-owned grocery stores called food co-ops to make healthy food more accessible. And time and again, they faced challenges accessing the money that they needed to buy or lease buildings, equipment, and cover other expenses involved with starting or expanding businesses. This was because of the community ownership model. There wasn't a single owner credit score to check or a single owner personal guarantee to protect a bank loan. So co-op developers were going to seek grant funds from a local foundation called the Haymarket People's Fund. This foundation realized that as small businesses, co-ops could repay loans as long as those loans were structured to work for the shared ownership co-op model. And out of these conversations between the foundation and the region's co-op developers, the co-op fund was born. Over the next half a century, we expanded from financing just food co-ops to financing all different types of co-ops in our seven-state Northeast region. And we now have a $40 million loan portfolio. Roughly a third of that is financing food co-ops. Another third is financing worker-owned small business co-ops. And the final third is supporting different models of tenant-owned housing co-ops with some farmer co-ops thrown in for good measure. As a small fund, we were laser-focused on providing co-op-appropriate loan capital. And when I came on in staff in 2010, five of our six staff were lenders. This left very little time for deep outreach to emerging communities, coaching early stage projects, or training potential community development partners. By the mid-2010s, we realized that we had to change. Following the murders of Trayvon Martin, Michael Brown, and so many others, we started asking more about why our lending wasn't supporting more majority Black, Latino, and Indigenous co-ops. So coming out of that inquiry and accelerated by the pandemic, we expanded our program to include what we call the learning team. And this team, which includes Carolyn and Johan, who are here with me today, and a couple others, a lot of coaching and convening and program management capacity that helps build an equitable co-op development ecosystem in which all communities can achieve justice and opportunity through thriving cooperative enterprise. So we currently have a 15-person team, including six people on the lending team, four people on the learning team, and five other folks, including me, who are involved with raising funds, communications, and other operational tasks. We're still predominantly a lender, but with a more balanced organizational profile. And you and anyone else can learn more about us at www.coopfund.coop.
Co-op Fund, coop.coop.
Yep, coopfund.coop.
Okay, so you mentioned Jonah and Carolyn. Carolyn, could you start off by just telling us what you do and how you got involved in CFNE?
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm Carolyn Utzelvetter, and I am the program director for CFNE, and I lead the learning team, which Micha talked a little bit about in his introduction. I'm based outside of Boston, and I actually originally came to CFNE as a borrower. So in 2013, my workplace, A Yard and a Half Landscaping, bought out our boss, became a worker co-op and bought her out. And CFNE was the primary lender who made that purchase possible. I served there as co-CEO for about 5 years after that, and then transitioned over to CFNE in 2019 after A Yard and a Half kind of had their feet under them as a worker co-op. And I moved over to CFNE as part of their effort to better support Spanish-speaking borrowers and borrowers who maybe did not come with as much financial readiness because of their own life experiences. And then the pandemic happened, and the rest is history.
All right. Jana, what's your history?
Johan Matthews, everyone, Ecosystem Strategy Manager here at CFNE.
What is your title?
Ecosystem Strategy Manager.
Okay.
Yep. And so for, the last decade plus, 12 years or so, I've been working in the field of community economic development, initially just because I felt called to do so. I was at Americo Vista working to alleviate poverty or whatever story we're telling ourselves, bottles of poverty, going into neighborhoods and helping out as best we could. And, over time, I started working with local leaders to create programs. I started working with nonprofits to build their capacity. I started working with entrepreneurs to help them access capital. And, throughout that time, I had been exposed to co-ops, and I was always curious. But, maybe 7 years in, I realized, I need to do more with this co-op thing, with this community ownership thing, because I've helped people access information, I've helped people access money, and it's not enough. People need each other. And so I really started to focus on that. We put on a lot of different events and simulations to help people think about what community ownership could look like. This was all pre-19, and helping nonprofits work together and all these types of things I was doing. And so by the time it was 2020, and there was an opportunity to get to know the cooperative fund and work with them, it just kind of was a perfect fit. And so we, been co-creating the learning team and, my role and the work we were doing together. So, that's what brought me here. And, it's been an awesome time.
So what is an ecosystem strategy manager?
So when I think about the ecosystem, I think about the neighborhood. This is the environment that supports our lives as people. So the neighborhood, and what are the strategies we can put in place to really engage the neighborhood and to help them engage in cooperative enterprises.
So Mr. Rogers called the neighborhood, Mr. Rogers' neighbors, was everybody was a member of the neighborhood. And he invited everybody to come in and be a member. And he said that what was most important was that what matters is not winning ourselves, it's individualism. But what matters is that by working together, we all can win. So that's a good way of looking at your ecosystem strategy manager, a neighborhood where we all work together and we win together. Okay. So, Micha, you've talked about CFNN and how it got started, what you do. So can one of you give me a story about a borrower or somebody that came in to get a loan, maybe did not have the resources, maybe didn't have the individual that had the assets, perhaps even never had a loan before? I remember my father was 5'10", 280 pounds. He had been a sergeant in World War II. He was a guy that kicked butt. He worked on the railroad, blue-collar worker, and fierce, strong. There were six kids. We all towed and, you know, hated to hear my mom say, wait till your dad gets home. But I went to him once when they were trying to get a loan, and I watched him become very meek, and I was sad for my dad. I may have been 14 years old. And so when I think about going getting a loan, it's that image of mainly a black person going and get a loan from a white person and have to beg almost. Get almost like get on your knees and beg somebody, and all your self-worth and dignity goes out the door. So would one of you talk to us about somebody coming into borrowing and what it's like when they come in to the cooperative fund of the Northeast to get a loan? What would they be the same white man putting through the hoops?
Yeah, you just really summed up, I think, what a lot of borrowers expect. And the fear that we face, and the fear that we're actually, you know, sort of helping to coach people through in starting to form a relationship with us. And, you know, I experienced that from the borrower's side. You know, a yard and a half is majority Central American workforce. So, you know, I and my coworkers, we're all Latino. None of us ever foresaw being business owners. If anything, we felt pretty lucky to be in a workplace that, even though landscaping is, at least in our part of the country, it's pretty exploitative of immigrant labor. We felt like we landed someplace that had safe working conditions, had fair wages. And, you know, that was the reason why when our boss started talking about retiring, we all agreed we can't let this go to a third party outside buyer. We need to figure out a way that we can buy this thing ourselves, because somebody from the outside, we're not going to keep the safe working conditions. We're not going to keep the fair wages. We're not going to keep the opportunities for professional advancement. And at the same time, the idea of a bunch of folks, many of whom didn't have even a high school education, who had just really come to this country to make money and send it back home, the idea of forming a business together and then trying to get financing for it was really daunting. And
daunting. I would say scary daunting. As hell, but okay. Yes. Daunting. We'll use daunting. Okay.
No, scary as hell. Absolutely. Because it's like, yes, we had a strong business. We knew that we could pay our everyday bills, but could we pay back a loan? And, you know, most folks, the experience they had with financial institutions was, you know, payday lenders, not being able to get a credit card or having a very high rate, you know, being in a neighborhood that didn't maybe even have a bank. So the idea of, oh, now we're going to go to this lender and they're going to give us a loan. Yeah, scary as hell is exactly right. And our experience with CFNE, my coworker, Maggie Cohn, still works for the fund. She was our loan officer. And she really helped demystify the process and was like, we're not underwriting you individually. We're not asking for your personal credit scores. We're not asking you to put your, you know, personal savings, if you have any, on the line. We're underwriting the business, the co-op. So I'm going to get to know you. This is not a online 24-hour approval, high interest rate, confusing fees kind of scenario. This is, we're going to get to know each other. It's going to be a process. It's going to be iterative. You're going to give me what you have about the business, and I'm going to ask you a bunch of questions. And she said, you know, don't feel bad if you don't have it all right. We're going to learn together. And I was so appreciative, because the things that I learned during that lending process made me a better business owner, made the co-op stronger. You know, Maggie asked for a cash flow projection, a three-year cash flow projection.
Okay.
And, you know, when you're a strong existing business, you don't have to worry about cash flow so much. But she knew when we took out that loan, we would have to worry about it. So she, you know, sent me a template. She's like, here's how you fill it out. And man, I used that thing for the next 3 years when people were like, I don't know, can we pay our bills? I'd be like, let's look at the cash flow projection. So the lending process actually made us stronger. And she really walked us through, here's what we need. Here's how you know you can afford the loan. She helped, you know, one of the other challenges of being part of a group that's traditionally excluded from kind of the mainstream economy is we don't have a guy, you know, we don't have a broker or an accountant or whatever. So she helped us to find, you know, an accountant who was familiar with co-ops, a lawyer who could help represent us in the deal, who worked on co-op conversions, really opened her kind of Rolodex to people in the co-op movement who could support us. So that, you know, the people in her neighborhood, she invited us to get to know them. And that's, you know, now that I'm part of CFNE, I can say that's really how we roll, is that we value the relationships and the durability and being really transparent about what we can do and what we expect from our borrowers in that partnership.
So a yard and a half.
Mm-hmm.
It's a landscaping company,
mm-hmm.
which you were working for, and there was an owner, an individual owned it. And did I understand that you just say that you are Latino, Hispanic?
I'm Cuban-American, yeah.
You're Cuban-American.
Yeah.
Okay. So you're not first generation, though, I assume.
My mom came from Cuba in the 60s when Castro took power.
Okay.
Yeah. And then I grew up in North Carolina. There's a weird Cuban enclave in North Carolina, and so I grew up in that.
I knew Miami and Puerto Rico, but okay, North Carolina. All right.
Immigration is weird, man. Where there is support, that's where we go.
So you're Cubano in North Carolina, and somehow you got to Boston. You're in Boston, right?
Correct. Yeah, okay. I came up here for divinity school and got stuck, as students do.
And Miha, are you from Boston also?
Yeah, I grew up in Boston.
Okay. So Carolyn, you're working for a yard and a half. Are you out with a lawnmower on the lawns, or what were you doing there?
When I started, it was just a summer job. Again, I was at Divinity School. I had the summer off, and I was working during the school year. I was doing my field practicum at a house for women with HIV, and one of the other staff there was like, oh, there's these nice ladies who come and do my yard. You should get to know them. That'd probably be a fun summer job. And so I met the former owner, Eileen, and she offered me a job, and I did. The first summer, I pushed a lawnmower 10 hours a day, 6 days a week. It's hard work. And, you know, like I said, Eileen was really different in that she believed in her employees. She believed that immigrants were smart and hardworking and had helped her build the business, which is why she wanted to turn the business over to us. And she really let people grow because she felt like that would grow the company. So over the years, you know, she made me a job offer when I graduated. I started studying landscape design. She started teaching me about the financials of the business and how to do estimating and all that stuff. And sort of grew me into somebody who could be part of the leadership team that she formed. Because, of course, one of the challenges when you transition to employee ownership is all the stuff that lives in the owner's head, right? You got to pass it on to your employees. So she, you know, created a team probably 5 years in advance to start handing over all of her knowledge and all of her relationships and processes and stuff to be able to have the business be really strong after she left.
Okay. So what I... main topic I got from what you said, your experience with Yard and a Half and then coming to work for CFNE, is to work together, forming relationships to help the people that are borrowing money to learn the whole process of borrowing money from CFNE. As a matter of fact, it could be borrowing money from anybody, but you're talking specifically about CFNE. What's that process like and how it's needed? And if they don't know something, like how do you produce a 3-year cash flow, and that can be daunting, then help you learn or help you get somebody that would help you to learn, like an accountant, bookkeeper, but somebody that can help you. And is that how you all started with this? No, first, what did you learn from there? And I think I want to go to Johan for this. What are some of the things you learned as a result of these kinds of loans, like a yard and a half?
Gotcha. Yeah, I would say something that really stood out to the team was that some neighborhoods don't have all the neighbors in place.
Okay.
Right? Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, some neighbors have left, right? Because decades of disinvestment has left that community without the supports it's needed, right? And in this case, we're thinking of the co-op neighborhood. So what are the things that co-ops need to survive in their neighborhood, right? Carolyn mentioned a few of them that our loan officer at the time, Maggie, helped her to connect to outside of her neighborhood, right? So there are some neighborhoods that have these rules in play, and there are some neighborhoods that don't because of decades of disinvestment, racially motivated or otherwise. These neighborhoods don't have what they need to support co-op life. And so we learned that. And so how do you regenerate that capacity? We know that these communities are informally engaged in business and working together to solve their problems. How do we help them to actually participate in the formalized co-op economy? You know, this business model where more than one person owns it and controls it together. Because once we can do that, now we can get into having neighborhoods where, you know, co-op life is sustainable and flourishing. So, you know, we can't just depend on our friends. They have to have that capacity within their communities. And so one of the things we did to respond to that, to help to create this homegrown capacity for cooperation and cooperative enterprise, would be to create this program we're calling the Co-op Navigator Fellowship. Now, this is a 3-year learning experience for co-op interested entrepreneurs and organizers, as well as community centered, locally led economic development institutions. So these are organizations that, you know, are trying to serve a particular community, whether it's an indigenous community in Maine, a black community in upstate New York, an immigrant community in Rhode Island, and so on and so forth, right? They have communities they're trying to serve already, and they may be interested in how the cooperative model can help that community solve those problems they're trying to solve. And so in this fellowship, we partnered with 5 of these institutions across the Northeast to identify a fellow, right? This co-op interested organizer or entrepreneur who could help that organization to build out its capacity to facilitate cooperative enterprise. We already help people do business. Could we help people do cooperative business? We're doing workforce development. Could we help these workforces come together to create companies and so on and so forth? So that's a lot of what we're trying to do with this, just regenerate that homegrown capacity to help those communities engage in cooperative enterprise, to help those ecosystems or those neighborhoods have the roles they need and have those roles be in connection with each other, right? Have these neighbors be neighborly, mm-hmm. right? Because these people aren't always connected to each other, right? And so that's a lot of what we've tried to do with that program. So right now we've got 5 fellows in 5 different neighborhoods across the Northeast working with a locally led organization to build out that capacity.
So could I become a co-op navigator?
Absolutely.
what would I have to do?
So each cohort is going to be a fellow for up to 3 years, right? If they can be identified by their host site, right? They have a relationship with the host site knows them, they identify them, and then they work with that host site for 3 years to learn, and we've brought in folks they can relate to, right? Culturally relevant mentors, so they can learn from those mentors who've navigated the cooperative world. Then they can identify opportunities in that community with the host site, and then help that host site to build this capacity to, you know, serve a larger audience of people to really integrate what that fellow has learned. So for you, it would be finding an institution that you can work with. And once we complete this cohort and we start a new cohort, you apply and we've got you.
So are these cohorts individuals, or are they teams of people trying to start a co-op? What's in a co-op? They're individuals.
Yes.
Okay, and then in this 3 years, they're learning about the whole upside inside out of what a co-op is?
Yes.
Okay. So you're a long way from funding.
Possibly. But I would say the fellows that we've gathered all are located at different ends of the spectrum of familiarity with co-ops. Some are seasoned co-operators, right? They've been in a co-op for almost a decade, right? But they didn't have a formalized business education. They just made it happen. Some have never seen or been a part of a co-op, limited exposure, right? And so we have members across that whole spectrum, members who are younger, members who are older. We have members who are very exposed, members who are not very exposed, members who are seasoned entrepreneurs but have been trying to figure out, how do I do group economics in my community as an entrepreneur? Whereas some are skilled organizers, you know, working on specific campaigns, however, don't know much about business. So we brought together an eclectic bunch who are interested in deepening their expertise and doing so in a cultural, you know, in a culturally relevant way, a way that's in integrity with the communities they're trying to serve. Because as you said about your father, a lot of us show up to the service provider, whether it's the bank, business advisor, the accountant, the lawyer, and we leave ourselves behind, right? We don't see the value of how we show up in the world because for decades the government didn't. And so that perpetuates, and now we're, you know, trying to fix that.
We're gonna have to take a break, but Carolyn says she's Cubano. What, I hear a little accent from you, John. Where are you from? What's your background?
I'm from an island now known as Vincent and the Grenadines.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Miha is Bostonian. Okay, so we got the whole round. So I get that you are a funding agency that is acting like an educational institution for folks to come and learn about co-op and borrowing. So that's what we've talked about so far this first half. We're going to come back after the first break, and I would love to get some more examples, some more stories of the types of people who have come in for loans and what they have experienced with CFNE. We'll be right back. Please don't touch that dial. Welcome back, everybody. This is Vernon Oaks, and the program is Everything Co-op. And we have some folks from the Northeast who lend money, or at least that's what they threaten to do. It sounds like they're an educational institution that say they will lend you some money. They have $40 million in assets to do that. We've been on the air a little over 10 and a half years with this show. And National Co-op Bank, another lender, I'm not sure they do as much training as you guys do, but another lender that lends to the co-op world, their mission is to support co-ops and their members by providing financial products, innovative financial products, and in low-income or low-resource communities. They've been a great partner also. They've taught us a lot about the co-op world. And I'm glad to have CFNE on today. And before we took the break, I said that we would come back and talk about more stories, and I want to go right into that. Who can give us another story of an organization or a group of people that have come in and asked for loans and what their experience have been?
Yeah, thanks, Vernon. So I want to tell the story of Ward Lumber because I think it really highlights that it takes a neighborhood to raise a co-op. So Ward Lumber was founded in 1890 by Harvey Ward to saw logs into building materials for communities in New York's Adirondack communities in the mountains.
Wait, I'm sorry, did you say 1890?
1890, that's right, 130 plus years ago.
Okay, ward number 1890. I got it. Go ahead. I'll try to stay up.
Yeah, yeah. So the business was passed down through four generations of the Ward family until it landed with J. Ward. They grew to have 50 employees located in two locations in Malone and Jay in New York. And the lumber company really anchors the local construction economy. So when it became clear that the fifth generation of the Ward family wasn't interested in taking over the business, they really had to start exploring options that would preserve the family legacy and that would do right by their employees and the communities that they were working in. And they came across employee ownership. And just like Yard and a Half, they started to explore, how could we sell this existing sole proprietor business to the workers? So, you know, this was a really great example of how the neighborhood can come together to support co-op development. There were a lot of organizations involved in the success of this transition. So they included a number of local economic development organizations like the Adirondack North Country Association. They involved a national lumber industry purchasing co-op that Jay Ward's grandfather actually helped start, called LDM Advantage, right? So they really understand the lumber industry. They involved co-op developers like one of our close partners, the Cooperative Development Institute. They involved public sector players. The local Small Business Development Center office was key to helping the co-op build its business plan and to connect them with the statewide Empire State Development Agency that provided a grant to support the transition. And the neighborhood also includes co-op lenders. So CFNE was there. We helped bring in a much larger community development lender called Capital Impact Partners. And then the selling owner also provided a loan to help transition the business to the workers.
So Capital Impact Partners is right here in D.C. or in Virginia, but okay. They came out of NCB.
That's right.
Co-op Bank. Okay.
That's right. Yeah, their roots are in co-ops, and this was the first what we call a co-op conversion, an employee ownership transition that they had done. We helped bring them into the deal, and since then they've done others, which is really exciting to have a much larger financial institution driving capital into this space.
So what year is this conversion happening?
So this conversion was happening at the end of 2020 and into 2021.
So right during the pandemic.
Right during the pandemic, and folks might remember that the building sector was booming during the pandemic. Supply chains, everyone was stuck at home. And so for folks who had some extra money, like, hey, now's a nice time to do that, like, nice sprucing up in our house that we've always been deferring. And so Ward Lumber actually had a very successful first year as a co-op. And what that meant was that they could distribute the profits to their worker owners, to the 50 worker owners, of approximately $34,000 per workers.
Hold on a second. You're telling me that they're in business for uno año, 1 year, and they made enough money, enough profit, that for 50 employees, they got a check, a Christmas bonus or something, for an additional $34,000. Their annual salary, their wages, whatever you call it, they got that, plus they got another $34,000.
Yeah.
Isn't this
life
in the Wall Street
changing.
Journal?
Right. Exactly. Employee ownership has the opportunity to be life-changing, right? So Jay Ward talks about
life-changing. This is family-changing. This is community. $34,000? You know my mom and dad could do with $34,000? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Jay Ward talks about one of the worker owners who had been formerly incarcerated and, you know, was living in housing instable situation. And, you know, you think about what that $34,000 did for him, you know, changed his life, right? So then you multiply that across the rest of the worker owners. So it's not just the individual benefits, but then you're really talking about community benefits, right? That the transition, the preservation of this business through converting it to employee ownership drove a lot of capital just across the community.
So you get the preservation.
So, you know, that's why, like, Senator Kirsten Gillibrand at the ribbon cutting for the conversion came out, right? And she was touting employee ownership, which then helps the next generation of potential employee-owned companies start to hear, okay, this is something that's important. We should be paying attention to this.
So you preserve the jobs for the 50 employees, similar to the preserving of the jobs of the yard and a half. So you also provide lumber to the community. In preserving those jobs for those 50 employees in those two sites, you still help that community. If somebody had come in and bought that business, they may have taken that business away from the communities.
Absolutely.
So that business, and the jobs stay there. Go ahead.
The jobs stay there, and the profits stay there, right? Because, again, the profits get distributed to members of the community who work in those lumber yards. So that means that, you know, the local economic ripple effects of that business being locally rooted are massive.
So in my MBA, I had a couple econ classes, and the thing I did not understand at the time was the multiplier effect, okay, of how money stays in the community and turns in the community. In the black community, it was one or two times that the money stayed in the community. Somebody went out and worked, and they spent the money on the way home or whatever, but it didn't come back to the community, or if it did, it was only spent one time. In the white or the majority or the wealthy communities, it may be up to seven times. In Tulsa, Oklahoma, and Black Wall Street, it was 32 times that money turned. I wonder what it's like for yard and a half in upstate New York in those two communities where those 50 employees got $34,000. Did they go down to Manhattan and spend their money, or California? Now, the money didn't do what it does often, and that is there's an outside stock owner who gets that profit of $34,000, and they may live in a different community, perhaps even China or Japan or somewhere overseas in London or something. Money stays in the community. What you're doing, Mr. Joseph, is really showing how important co-ops are for an individual, for a family, for a community. And that is just fascinating. You want to keep this story? I love it.
What I think I'd love to do is invite Carolyn to talk a bit about our efforts now to make more Ward Lumbers and more yard and a halves and ensure that the neighborhood that was there to support Ward Lumber is there to support all of the small Main Street businesses in our communities.
Okay, Carolyn.
Yeah. So one of the things that we've been working on is an initiative called the Northeast Transition Initiative. We call it NETI. Everything has to have a cute little acronym, so NETI. And this is a partnership with Cooperative Development Institute and a whole bunch of the local and regional partners. Micha mentioned Adirondack North Country Association. They're one of the partners. But, you know, basically we put our heads together, those of us who've been seeing the potential of these co-op conversions, these employee ownership transitions, and we said, well, what do we see getting in the way? People don't know about it as an option. There's not, you know, the majority of these don't have a senator coming to the ribbon cutting. Mm-hmm. They don't have cameras there. So, okay, how do we help economic developers and, you know, in neighborhood economic development organizations know about this as an option? How do we help workers who are going through this not be like us at a yard and a half, casting around trying to find who can help us learn how to run a business? So we looked at all the hurdles and we said, well, let's try and design an initiative that's going to address these. So we have a fellowship for economic developers and capital providers who see the potential of employee ownership to learn how they can actually go out in their community, talk to business owners who are thinking about retirement, engage them in exit planning, engage them in connecting with professionals who can help guide them through the conversion process. We have an employee training program for worker owners so that they'll be ready to take the reins. So it's, you know, we're developing a set of video modules that they can access online at their own pace and learn how do we run a board meeting? How do we understand how money flows through a cooperative? All these things that you need to know in order to become a, you know, fully participating worker owner. We're going to have a public awareness campaign that, you know, deploys what they call trusted messengers, you know, the people in your neighborhood to talk to you about what's possible in your neighborhood in transitioning to employee ownership and really get the word out to workers and business owners and, you know, community development folks broadly. And so, you know, the intention is really to, throughout the Northeast, vastly increase the ability to support businesses transitioning to employee ownership, whether they are businesses with majority black and brown workforces who really can benefit the most from that transfer of wealth, that $34,000 a piece deployed back into your own community, but also in rural communities like up in Maine where you see a rapidly aging population and, you know, baby boomer business owners who maybe their kids don't want the business. Maybe they think their only option is to shutter it up and sell it off for assets. Letting them know there's another opportunity to keep that business that might be an anchor in a small rural community, keep it open, keep it providing jobs, keep it, you know, fueling the economic engine of that small rural community.
You're talking about the silver tsunami.
Exactly.
Baby boomers, which I'm in that category. Own businesses. I think they were saying like 75% of small businesses are owned by the silver tsunami, and so they'll be up in mass. And too often, when the generation that follows doesn't want it, it somehow closed down or moved out or sold and moved out of the community, where Ward Lumber and a yard and a half are examples of how the business can stay. And even what I really liked about the yard and a half story is how those individuals learn so much. Okay. And I'm sure the same thing happened. Those employees, those 50 employees had to learn a lot. And that information that they learn helps them in the business, but it also helps them in their personal life. If you can learn how to do a cash flow for a business, you can do one for your family. Okay. A budget. Learning how to really manage money together. And if the home is fortunate enough to have a husband and a wife, they can learn how to sit down and manage money together. And money has been known as the number one breakup or divorcer. But if you can learn how to talk about money and solve issues, I want to buy a boat and she wants to buy some dresses and shoes. How do we figure that out? Okay. And I like her in those dresses and stuff, but I don't want to spend any money on it. So how do you figure that out? How do you do this? Okay. This is fascinating. So I thought we were going to talk about, you know, money and loaning money, but we've been talking educational stuff, which is the number one reason I like co-ops, is the fifth principle, education, training, information. But you all have made it education from the sixth principle viewpoint. This is what I see. Sixth principle is cooperation among co-ops. But it's this sort of working together, this neighborhood, these neighbors coming together to support these employees or potential these employees that become owners and these employees that can become potentially owners. Now, I don't hear of many stories. I haven't heard of one other story where people have made $54,000 each in the first year. The first year. That is fascinating. When did this happen? In 2020?
2021. You know, and I don't want to give people the impression that their first year in a co-op, they'll make, you know, a profit distribution of $34,000. Like, this was a particular case because of the industry, because of the pandemic. But I do think that it's illustrating of what can happen as we expand employee ownership.
Well, it's seldom that a business makes a profit in the first year. In a startup situation, it may be a 5-year cash flow projection, Carolyn, to see where one breaks even and then start making profit. So yeah, it's that's not normal, but that's newsworthy. I mean, every channel, every evening, Wall Street Journal should be running this story, and that's what we've got to get people to know about co-ops first and foremost. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I think what's really interested about these employee ownership transitions is that, yes, it was the first year that Ward Lumber was a co-op, right? And so they made that profit in their first year as a co-op, but they had been operating as business for 130 years. They had the relationships across their neighborhood, right, with their clients, with their suppliers, with their workers. And so whereas startups inherently are risky because they're building from the ground up. It's risky for lenders. It's risky for the entrepreneurs. With employee ownership transitions, it's quite a bit more secure. And so that's why we're really excited about this NEDI project, is the potential to bring employee ownership to far more people in a far more secure, stable way.
Wow. If you haven't read Dr. Jessica Gordon Nimhard's book, Collective Courage, everybody's shaking their head. So, yeah, she talks about how the co-op is much more successful than a regular capitalistic business starting up because of all of this learning that has to happen. Okay. And that sometimes they decide not to do the business, but that's because the learning happens and there's not this failure that goes along with it. So let's talk about the future, because the two examples that you've given are just absolutely phenomenal. So how do you see the future? And I understand that CF&E has been in the business for 50 years. You have not 120 yet, not 120 years yet, but you've been in business 50 years. Can anybody put their crystal ball and talk about the next 50 years or five?
So I'll share a little bit. At CF&E, we believe the future is cooperative. And so that's how we're positioning ourselves. You know, I think after the pandemic, and Mika taking the helm, and, you know, Carolyn coming on board, the organization, along with many other organizations across the country, trying to answer the call for equity, to see that some people weren't being included in the story of America and the story of what business and ownership can do for a family or a neighborhood or a community. And so how do we do so, right? How do we have that future, that cooperative future? You know, who do we have to become, I think, is the question. And so we've become cooperators. We've been working with our partners to co-create these fellowships. We've been working with our clients to co-create new services. And we're trying to become the type of organization that is capable of bringing a world where people can cooperate to meet the problems and to solve those problems in their community, you know, with grace and harmony. So that's what I think we're moving towards. And I think it takes co-evolution, right? Folks in communities have to learn and to become more, and we have to learn and become more alongside them. And so that's what I see happening in the 3 years plus that I've been here working with these beautiful people. And I think that's going to continue to happen. So I think the future is cooperative, and we have to become able to do so and work alongside the communities who we want to see cooperate as well.
So if I can jump in on...
Oh, Carolyn, please, go ahead.
Yeah, if I can jump in on the end of that, you know, Johan mentioned coevolution, and this is why we call ourselves a learning team rather than like the technical assistance department, which is sort of a jargony industry term, is because we learn as much from our clients as we're sharing with them. And I feel like that's a big part of where CF&E is going. Is, you know, we had our roots in food co-ops. That's how we got started. And, you know, as different co-op sectors have evolved, we've evolved with them. And so, you know, since the pandemic, there's been a huge, uptick in worker co-ops. And we've really tried to rise to meet that and make sure that our loan products work for whether it's a five-person startup or a $2 million conversion, make sure we can meet those worker co-ops where they are. And, you know, I think last year was the first year that we actually deployed more, Mitha can tell me the right thing, did more loans to worker co-ops than to any other sector. So I feel like we're really trying to be responsive to changes in the co-op world as people are coming together to solve their problems in different ways. How can we make sure that we're there with both the capital and the coaching to meet them?
Fantastic. So your history is food co-ops. Food co-ops are owned and controlled by the, most of them are owned and controlled by the people that buy in the co-op, buy the food. It's called a consumer co-op, where an employee co-op or worker co-op is owned by the employees. And Yard and a Half and Ward Lumber, the employees owned it. So that's called a worker cooperative. And any business you can think of could be a worker co-op. When you think of consumer co-ops, you've got the food co-ops, you've got the rural electric co-ops, you've got housing co-ops, you have credit unions. So there's some very large numbers. There's about 130 million Americans that belong to co-ops. About one-third of our population belong to co-ops. Because they're in these consumer co-ops, most often they don't know that the rural electric or the credit union is a co-op, which is what we're about doing and training them and teaching them about what a co-op is. So the next 50 years is getting into other sectors of the co-op world for you guys and increasing the neighborhood. It's what I'm hearing you say, getting more players in this and more people trained up about it. Miha, do you have anything to add about the future?
Yeah, I mean, thinking about the future is scary, right? You know, we have these converging crises happening right now. We have political crises. We have crises, social crises, you know, resulting from racial wealth gap and the deep history there. We have a climate change crisis. And when there are crises, then we need our neighbors, right, to survive. And so we know both the future is cooperative because we love cooperatives and we want that to spread, but also it's about survival, right? That we need that working together, that community control of the economy in order to thrive and survive. And so, you know, that's a pretty big charge. Or, you know, there are only a handful of organizations providing capital to co-ops. And so if we're, you know, this might be a little big on the soapbox, but like we're going to need to grow and adapt to be able to do more, faster, better in order to rise to the moment of these overlapping crises. And it's really exciting, right? Really gives us all a reason to get up in the morning and get excited about our work.
So you started out by saying it's scary, and you ended up by saying it's exciting. Scary and exciting. The future. So, Miha, I would like for you to end this for us by telling us the message you would like to leave people with.
Yeah, I mean, the co-op movement is all around in every community. I think we have sometimes a branding issue where there's lack of awareness of those co-ops, of the credit unions, et cetera, et cetera. And really excited about this radio program to help expand that message. But really the message that I want to leave people with is that there's a place in the co-op movement for everyone. And there's a need for everyone to tie in with the co-op movement. And so, you know, work with your neighbors, find out who's in your neighborhood, and let's get working.
And you can find you guys by going to your webpage, which is
www.coopfund.coop, COOPFUND.COOP.
Everybody, we thank you guys for being with us this morning. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next Thursday. Please live cooperative and be a part of the neighborhood.
The preceding program was paid for by Everything Co-op.